Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
From Tokyo, Japan, I'm your host, Chris Lamont, here with Medley Armema and Young Diogenes. Today, we're going to discuss the question of bias and what makes digital deception and disinformation campaigns so effective. Microsoft released a report in September entitled Sophistication, Scope, and Scale, Digital Threats from East Asia Increase in Breadth and Effectiveness, highlighting, among other findings, how AI-generated images and videos are contributing to the effectiveness of China's influence operations. Young Diogenes, you've talked to us in the past about the risk of AI-fueled disinformation, and in our season opener, we talked to Mark Owen Jones, the author of Digital Authoritarianism in the Middle East, about how ubiquitous influence campaigns now are on social media platforms. Can you tell us more about this report?
You bet. So it's about 20 pages long. It's by a group called the Microsoft Threat Intelligence Group, and they look into Chinese influence operations, or IO for short, that they've noticed recently and some of the changes that they've seen from these Chinese actors. They also discuss some North Korean cyber operations, how they're using state-associated influencers and sort of reducing, like, not indicating what their role is. They may be newscasters or whatever, but they're just saying they're influencers. But the part that I actually thought was the most interesting is AI-generated imagery being used to affect U.S. voters and presumably voters in other regions as well.
So, Young Diogenes, why images?
So, two of the images that they list pretty prominently are interesting, in particular the first one, which has a shot of the Statue of Liberty with sort of these peach-colored flames or vapors behind it. And it says, like, even the grammar is a little off, but it says, Democratic and Freedom's the Goddess of Violence for the Statue of Liberty. And then another one is a Black Lives Matter change where they have a directly state-connected site that posts this Black Lives Matter kind of poster or content GIF. And then a couple hours later, they have someone who is supposedly a U.S. voter, but Microsoft, this Microsoft group has figured out that it's not. It's just someone pretending to be a U.S. voter, like reposting that and having their commentary associated with it. And I mean, we knew this was going to happen, but I think it's interesting when you can use stuff like Midjourney and Adobe Firefly to begin generating content that's generally actually, well, maybe not generally, but often more appealing immediately and quicker to generate than something that had to be handcrafted in the past and would look kind of clunky.
Well, I think, YD, you're anticipating kind of my question on this, because this isn't the first time that we've had this kind of misinformation and disinformation campaigns. How would you say does the current kind of period we're going through, we're living through, and how does AI impact this equation when it comes to issues of social influence and other things? So how is this different from what would have been 10, 15, 20 years ago?
I think for the most part, it just makes things a little more salient, so slightly more likely to actually generate interest from individuals, while simultaneously making it easier for these kinds of actors, because it's not just going to be China, obviously, to generate content much more quickly.
Yeah. So speed, I suppose, is one of those things, and that's what you're hinting at. Another one is this issue of credibility. I was thinking a little bit about propaganda posters, and so much of what used to pass for propaganda, and I'm thinking also the Rwanda genocide and other things, was about categorizing the enemy as the other. It's about making the enemy less than human. The report seems to hint, and the recent kind of developments seem to hint at the opposite of this. And what I mean by that is that it's almost like a confidence game where you're actually using images and imagery that you are comfortable with. And that then kind of tends to lull you into a certain sense of security and a certain sense of confidence in what you're reading. And then you're more likely to accept whatever information is shared to you right through those channels. Chris, I know that you have studied ethnic conflict broadly as well. Have you noticed that pattern? I mean, is this just something that I'm just seeing, or is that what you think is happening here?
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of research to support what you were saying, and kind of going back to, for example, kind of the Holocaust, the kind of othering and the first stages of genocide and the such. And one thing that contributes to that that's interesting potentially in this report is that you had mentioned in the past, it seems like things were a little bit more kind of crude and obvious. Mm-hmm. And here, one of the things Microsoft highlights is the use of lifestyle influencers who don't really have any kind of outward kind of affiliation, stated affiliation with media, or even seem to really cover, for the most part, political issues or questions of geopolitics like the South China Sea. But these lifestyle influencers seem to be kind of harnessed as effective conduits to do the things that Medlier, you were mentioning, contribute to othering or contribute to amplifying a particular message. What is it about these types of accounts that make this believable, propaganda believable?
This is a question for you, because I mean, and Chris was kind of like asking a question I had in my mind, and it goes beyond just the current report, but this issue of, okay, so we see a lot of this kind of propaganda, we see a lot of this information. Again, this is a bit different. This doesn't hit you. It's not alienating you. It's not alienating other people either. It's actually the opposite of that. What are they playing at here, right? What is it about us as human beings that perhaps gives this kind of propaganda or this kind of manipulation information some legs to run on?
Well, I think two things immediately come to mind, which is, and you're both hinting at this, which is it's more effective if there's trust. And this allows you to generate content that among certain groups is going to be perceived as trustworthy more quickly. And if it isn't perceived as trustworthy initially, it also lets you establish targeting where you're doing A-B comparisons on which of these images is more effective at generating responses from users or generating trust based on the written text that a user responds to when they see the image. So those two things, A-B testing and generating trustworthy content quickly.
And the question of bias too, Young Diogenes. For example, like something might be as opaque as a social media influencer, lifestyle influencer sharing that, like, oh, look at Indonesia's new China-built bullet train. Look at how China is contributing to development globally. That this can message in conjunction with others does have an impact in terms of altering how people perceive China in a way that China desires.
Yeah, I mean, just to drill a little deeper on that, I think it seems fairly straightforward on why they would use influencers, because they've proven that maybe they have a particular speaking voice or an appearance or something that makes them more appealing to an audience than just some random kid that's trying to generate content on the internet that's interesting. So they can leverage the kinds of things that naturally appeal to human beings because those influencers have already been vetted to a degree.
Let's go back to the question of artificial intelligence. We started this conversation with and highlighting the two images that appear in the Microsoft report, like these artificially generated images. And we implied that even with the awkward English images, right? The first question I asked, images seem to be amplifying the influence, right? So AI is contributing to making influence campaigns more effective, not just by actors like China and potentially North Korea, but we could just say across the board, right? So states that want to engage in influence campaigns can now harness this new technology to make their influence campaigns more effective. And as Medlier says, it looks very different than the landscape that we saw in the 1990s in the context of influence campaigns centered around, for example, the wars in the former Yugoslavia, or in when it comes to Rwanda as well. So Young Diogenes, as somebody who focuses more on the tech side of this question, do you see the AI technologies as capabilities are increasing, the ability to amplify influence campaigns as is growing in a way that's going to dramatically change how we will engage with information coming from a variety of sources, whether it's a friend sending something in a group chat, or it's social media, or it's a media outlet, right?
I'm frankly surprised it's not happening a little more quickly.
So interesting.
These early efforts, like the way they probably initially caught this Statue of Liberty one, is that it has the classic, this will be familiar to many of our audience members at this point, but it has like six or seven fingers. And that's the kind of classic thing that AI always has a hard time with now. That's going to go away relatively quickly. It still happens a lot, but, and then we'll have fewer and fewer tools to be able to detect when it is AI. For whatever reason, it kind of reminds me of the development of drone warfare, which is like adding a remote control to a flying vehicle shouldn't be that difficult. But for whatever reason, to really get it down, or maybe to really kind of milk the defense industry and get it working consistently, it's taken decades to get that going really well. So I'm actually kind of heartened a little bit that this is going slower than I would anticipate, because with a small team of developers, I would think you'd be able to crank out pretty high quality content, do A/B testing in small audiences, and figure out stuff that is really appealing and trust building to a variety of people quite quickly. And no one might even notice it when you release it to a broader audience, because it's been so thoroughly tested by the AI and the individuals running the operation.
Is it possible that there is an emphasis here on quantity over quality? And in a way, both COVID, as well as just social media generally, has diluted our sense of quality. We seem to be more willing to put up with lower quality, both interviews in a way. I mean, now you go on TV and you see interviews from all over the place with all kinds of backdrops, kind of like what we're doing right now. And we don't seem to bat an eye at that, because we're like, yeah, we're used to that. COVID kind of like got us all locked down and we couldn't go anywhere. And then
I think they just want to get started. So right now they're just throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what they can get out there quickly.
So this is a digital version equivalent of the weather balloons that the Chinese kind of just floated above the continental USA. But supposedly, according to the latest reports we get from the U.S. intelligence agencies, that there wasn't any recording, collection of intelligence, or any transmission of it. It seemed to have just been kind of like a trial balloon, I guess, very appropriate.
Yeah.
And so this would have been one of those things. I mean, I suspect that there is also an element of again, preference for quantity over quality here. I'm not sure that we'll probably see this change as much. So before I ask...
By the way, you'll see from the article that they do have a lot of different groups that are almost competing against each other in different arenas to get content out. So it's almost like an entrepreneurial venture, like start a bunch of small... Yeah. businesses, quote-unquote, organizations within your larger organization and see who comes up with the most interesting stuff from their perspective.
So Chris, before I ask YD to change his profile, we got to change some of his settings and convert him more into like other kinds of searches and output. Do you think that this development, this report in particular, the Microsoft report, may actually kind of fuel the debate over TikTok? I mean, it seems that this just provides you more evidence that China is very much interested in this kind of disinformation campaign and kind of trying to trip and cause all kinds of havoc during the U.S. elections or any other time for that matter.
I mean, very, very broadly, in people's minds, they'll see them as connected, because on the one hand, you have TikTok, and a lot of the concerns about that are about the information, the data that the app collects from your device. Whereas here, what we're looking at are campaigns that are meant to influence how people perceive different actors. These are kind of U.S. as a foreign policy actor versus China as a foreign policy actor. And I think the nexus, what kind of ties these two things together is you're looking at kind of the platform that people can use to create content, distribute content, and have it viewed widely, and the kind of the generation of the creation of that content. And one thing that's really interesting here is that you're taking, in a sense, that you're making it much easier to create a lot more content. And I think one thing that is really alarming in a way that's kind of just briefly mentioned there in that Microsoft report is that, as Young Diogenes pointed out, that the Statue of Liberty, and as you mentioned, has like more fingers. And when you notice it, it's kind of like, that's really creepy.
Right.
It seems like really, really obviously fake.
But we are used, though, in this age of photoshopping, of seeing three legs or...
We are used to it.
This could very well be like just a mistake. Somebody tried to Photoshop the image. They were just...
Or it could be purposeful, similar to like the Nigerian prince, where you want to appeal to an audience that would actually... You want to figure out the demographics of people that are fooled by that kind of thing.
Okay.
Well, that's the interesting thing is people are genuinely... Like, people are sharing it. And so the thing is, we hinted at bias in the introduction. Why is it that you can see something and all the red flags are there that for whatever motivation, right, whether it's like a kind of a problem still in honing the kind of the image generation tool itself, or it's kind of photoshopped, or it's intentional, or it's whatever the motivation is, that not only is it shared, but it seemingly has an impact.
And that's a question I wanted to ask YD. I wanted him to kind of reprogram really fast and just kind of reset and just kind of tap into exactly that kind of information that you're just pointing out. Are there built-in biases that we have as humans that kind of condition us to receive this kind of information and then distribute it? Because you hinted at that, YD, when you're saying, well, yeah, but certain people actually are more likely. It could very well be that this is intentional because it selects out anybody who would obviously sniff it and understand what this is. But then people that are likely then to not even see that then can distribute it. And it's likely to have greater impact among those people. So that's exactly the kind of demographic it is targeting. So again, reprogram, reset. What say you when it comes to the issue of bias and the way our subconscious and the way of thinking goes about these things?
That's a really good question, by the way. One of the things that AI does let you do, again, more quickly, is you can ask it to find and generate content that is more likely to have an appeal for your audience. And you may not know, as the person generating the prompt, all right, which color schemes, which kind of historical architecture shapes, what's like George Lucas using Darth Vader, like it has an appeal because there's some historical connections there to samurai. And so it looks sort of familiar, but we don't know why, and we feel comfortable with it. We don't know why. AI can help us figure that out more quickly, or help these individuals figure that out more quickly. And so it's going to be more trusted. We're definitely wired for confidence. So people who present their opinions as very confidently are more likely to attract audiences than those who kind of equivocate, prevaricate. And AI can help you with all those kinds of things. There's tons of biases we could go through. We could probably do 10 episodes on confirmation bias and correspondence bias.
Is there one that is your favorite YD and that you think is especially applicable in this circumstance?
Traditionally, my favorite bias has been confirmation bias. But more recently, I've been looking at correspondence bias, because we have this tendency to blame other people's actions on flaws in their character,
right,
whereas our own actions are driven by circumstances and we didn't have a choice in doing it.
Ajis, what I really like about this conversation is, in the past when we talked about bias on this podcast, we've identified kind of two types of AI biases, and those were kind of the biases on the part of those who create a tool, like the kind of the programmers, and also biases that emerge from the data. And the difference here seems to be that instead of having a unintended consequence of bias, what we're doing is we're harnessing AI to learn more about and exploit biases that we already hold. This seems pretty concerning if AI is able to do this in a way that is effective.
Yeah, it's kind of like advertisers for the last century and probably going back for thousands of years have known the kinds of things that appeal to human beings. But now we can ask the AI to not only target specific biases, but just ask it to provide content that will have maximum appeal. And we don't even know which bias necessarily it's appealing to. It could be a combination of them to make it really interesting for the audience. And it's early days on that, but yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see the kind of stuff that comes out in the next couple of years. And it goes back to that kind of virus, antivirus conversations we had in some of our first episodes. Usually the virus actors have a slight lead time because the antivirus is always on the defense.
Interesting and worrying, because this brings me back to what Medlier had raised at the very beginning of this podcast, is kind of harking back to kind of propaganda from the 1990s that sought to inflame ethnic divisions or intensify othering. If those who wish to promote those types of campaigns now have access to data analytics and tools that will make othering much more effective and much easier to do, this suggests that we are entering into a very worrying domain, and something that, as Young Diogenes, you mentioned, it's in some respects surprising that we haven't seen more of this than we have already observed.
I know that we're running out of time, Chris. I was thinking as we're talking about this, again, this difference, this almost like this is a con game, that it's trying to buy somebody's confidence by not necessarily being disruptive, but just sharing information that may be just so different from reality that create a little bit of division and polarization. But it's not like hitting you in the face, like, again, those early propaganda kind of like examples we're talking about. And then I was thinking about, I think, was it the Black Mirror? I think Joanne is Awful. That was the first episode of the new season. And I thought about that and how I think one of the executives at Strawberry, I think was the name of the Netflix basic equivalent, and saying that, well, we tried other versions. We tried Joanne is Wonderful, and it tested really, really badly. So we went with Awful because negative emotions seem to actually elicit a more rapid reaction and also forceful reaction people towards others. And I'm wondering whether this is just a temporary lull, that at some point where you're kind of testing weaknesses, you're playing to the biases you're pointing, but at some point the nature of the propaganda changes, right? Because it can't be just kittens and, I don't know what else, rainbows. At a certain point, I think the nature of propaganda is such that it will always go back to the more negative images, to negative stereotypes, and to depolarization of society.
Because we have more intense reactions to that.
That's why I'm reminded of this point.
Like advertising or marketing professors in the 90s and just the industry generally saying that classic line of sex sells. That's been around for decades and decades, and I'm sure that'll continue to be true. But more recently, it feels like they've all discovered through various algorithms that like fear and anger actually sells even better than sex.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this is all kind of very concerning, and there's a lot
on
to,
that note.
To unpack. Yes, there's a lot to unpack from that.
We have a lot of episodes that end this way.
But
just leave you thinking.
But you also might think about, for example, it's not just, it will influence campaigns, how they're carried out, and kind of the bots that are being used, and also the images that are being generated of influencers who are often, because I think we're implying that they're all kind of people, kind of what is it that generates interaction? What is it that generates content? As fueling this, this raises a lot of questions relating to kind of regulation and governance of these technologies and international cooperation that we have delved into in the past and are going to revisit again in the future. But unfortunately, as all of our time is limited, we will have to leave it there. I hope that you've all enjoyed listening to this conversation. I've certainly enjoyed discussing questions of bias, deception, and disinformation with Medlier and Young Diogenes. Of course, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to join us for the next episode of On Air, a podcast at the intersection of AI and IR theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.